mother with red hair. Now I find out that it is really light brown. My mother asked me not to tell my father. What a state their marriage must be in. I wonder if my father knows that she wears a padded bra. She doesn't hang them on the line to dry, but I have seen them shoved down the side of the airing cupboard. I wonder what other secrets my mother has got.
Well, I can think of one, but you'll find out about that one on Monday. I'm saying no more for now. The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, aged 13 and three quarters, by Sue Townsend, was read by Nicholas Barnes. It was abridged by Elizabeth Proud, and the producer was John Tiderman.
This weekend, BBC Radio 4 Extra is listening to Les.
The muted strains of a Lionel Richie ballad join in a descant with the clink of champagne glasses. And behind a thicket, a cat was sick.
If I'm a pessimist and things turn out as well as I imagined, then I can say, well, there you are. But if it's slightly better, I'll go, well, I feel mollified.
Let's have a cup of tea, a gypsy cream and a Florentine fig wafer. You look as if you could do with something good down here.
Have you got a Devonshire split?
Join Ray Peacock and a host of special guests as we celebrate the wonderful work of Les Dawson. Listening to Les, Saturday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7.
The digital station for comedy, drama and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
So we've got drama coming up at 3 o'clock, and it's the final part of Wilkie Collins' tale of passion, deception and murder, Armadale. Before that, we come to the final part of Constable in Love by Martin Gayford. And at long last, after 7 years of courtship, Maria Bicknell and John Constable finally get to tie the knot. Now the serious production of paintings and of children can begin in earnest. The reader is Anton Lesser.
After the wedding, the newly married Mr. and Mrs. Constable departed on their honeymoon, accompanied by Dash the dog. They spent a little time in Salisbury and Southampton before arriving at Osmington, where they enjoyed a snug autumn in the vicarage with John and Mary Fisher. True to his word, Fisher provided paints, and Constable, perhaps spurred on by marital love, was extremely busy. He sketched and drew Weymouth Bay and the downs above. Meanwhile, in East Bergholt, attempts were being made to placate Dr. Rudd. Constable's sisters, Anne and Mary, went to visit him. Love, the rector told them, was not a sufficient reason to get married. What had happened was a sad waste from every point of view. Both his granddaughter and her new husband might have done better. A fine, handsome man such as Constable could easily have caught a woman of fortune. The sisters departed. Next, Mr. Travis, the village medical man, delivered a moral lecture to the elderly clergyman. "I'll not leave her a shilling," declared Rudd. "For God in heaven's sake, doctor," exclaimed Mr. Travis. "Think of what you are doing, persecuting her in your life and after your death too." Somewhat chastened, the rector agreed to leave something to Maria and her children, but cut her husband out. John and Maria finally returned to London on the 9th of December. There were naturally thoughts that they might spend Christmas in East Bergholt, but the atmosphere at the rectory had once more turned ominous. Again, Mr. Travis tested the waters on a visit. "I hear, doctor," he broached the delicate subject, "Mr. and Mrs. Constable would much like to visit Bergholt." "If they do," replied his host, "and call on me, I will not see them." The venerable clergyman observed that he could not avoid seeing them if they came to his church, but would not have the couple in his house. So it was decided that on the whole it would be better if John and Maria did not make a Christmas visit. In East Bergholt, the view was that Maria's father, Charles Bicknell, was not to be blamed for all that had happened. John's brother Abram wrote, "He is a most kind-hearted good man, but for the good of his children, whom he tenderly loves, he is obliged to submit to the doctor's tyrannical yoke." On January the 2nd, 1817, a small milestone was reached. Maria dined with her father, who forgave the words spoken between them on the night before the wedding. Charles Bicknell was not one to battle against established facts. He may also have been swayed by the fact that Maria was now expecting a baby, the first grandchild from his second family. In Burgold, the diplomatic offensive continued. Abram visited the rectory and delivered, according to his sister Anne, a veritable sermon on the text, "The duty of forgiveness when error was acknowledged." Mr. Travis followed this up and extracted, when the doctor was in one of his good moods, a promise that if Constable would write a proper letter of apology to himself and Mr. Bicknell, all would be well. Unfortunately, this was something Constable found hard to do. He felt he had done no wrong. On the contrary, that the fault was all on the other side. Whatever he wrote to Dr. Rudd, it was not sufficient. His allies were downcast. Abram urged that there is nothing degrading in endeavouring to conciliate an old man of 84. Poor Travis visited the rectory once more, only to be informed that, "If you can see a simple apology in this letter, it's more than I can." Dr. Rudd's objections now came down to the fact that he believed Constable had mocked him in church and drawn caricatures of him. Part of the problem, probably all along, was that there was pride and touchiness on both sides. Once more, Constable wrote, in a more openly apologetic vein. This time his letter was better received. Abram anxiously asked if it was satisfactory. "Pretty well. Very well," replied Dr. Rudd. He wished them both to be happy and would try to make them so. Meanwhile, he didn't want to have the matter mentioned again until he departed for his annual visit to London. On the whole, things seemed to be going well. At the Royal Academy, Constable showed his largest and most impressive array of work to date, including the splendid new pictures Flatford Lock, Wivenhoe Park, and A Cottage in a Cornfield, all products of a burst of activity in Suffolk just before the wedding. Maria miscarried, but became pregnant again shortly after, and Constable began looking for a house in the expectation of soon having a family. He rented a little dwelling at 1 Keppel Street near the British Museum. There began the best time of his and Maria's life together. "The 5 happiest and most interesting years of my life were passed in Keppel Street," Constable reminisced later. "I got my children and my fame in that house, neither of which I would exchange with any other man." On the 4th of December, Maria gave birth to a son. Dr. Rudd was somewhat mollified by this. Travis, ever the ambassador, told him the news. "You are a great grandfather, Doctor." At which he seemed not displeased, but said, "You must now approach me with additional respect, as I am a patriarch." He mentioned his intention of leaving the baby something. Constable was joyful. Indeed, no father could have been more pleased. Confronted with the offspring of a friend, he reported to Maria that, "It's a nice little baby, but no more to compare with our sweet duck than if it did not belong to the species." Constable, while calling his children ducks, was inclined to call his paintings children. The marriage of John and Maria was evidently close physically as well as emotionally. The frequency of Maria's pregnancies was evidence of that. Within 3 years of their marriage, they had as many children. When Constable was away, he missed her. "I am heartily tired of being away from my love. I miss you at night, and once thought I had you in my arms. How provoking." Towards the end of 1818, Constable made one more effort at reconciliation with Dr. Rudd. This time he left the rector with no further grounds for resentment. The elderly clergyman's mood slumped. Locally it was remarked that the doctor was very flat and dull, his spirits lower than had ever been known. On the 24th of December, 1818, Dr. Rudd changed his will, leaving an equal portion to Maria and each of her siblings. It was only just in time. In the new year, the rector began to appear bewildered. Towards the end, he wandered constantly from room to room, searching for Mrs. Rudd, dead for 8 years, and complaining that he had no money, betraying an inner anxiety that might explain much of his behaviour. He died on the 3rd of May, 1819, and Constable arrived on a visit just as the bell was tolling for him. Dr. Rudd's legacy, on which so much thought and anxiety had centred for so long, turned out to be rather smaller than might have been hoped. It amounted to £120 a year, which gain was offset by the fact that when it began to be paid, Charles Bicknell immediately and characteristically cancelled a small allowance he had been paying Maria. That year was the pinnacle of Constable's happiness. At the Royal Academy, he exhibited The White Horse, the first of his 6-foot canvases, which marked a further step up in the power and ambition of his art, and Constable was at last elected an Associate Royal Academician by one vote, 9 years after he had first put himself forward. The constables began renting a house in Hampstead during the summer, so Maria and the children could retreat from London. These months spent in the countryside north of the city brought great contentment. Constable found a new subject and a new obsession, painting the shifting clouds in the sky, which he did again and again, taking a vantage point on Hampstead Heath. This was the time when he produced the paintings by which he is now best known. In 1821, he exhibited The Hay Wain at the Royal Academy, and there was another addition to the Constable family, a second son. "Though I am in the midst of the world," Constable wrote to his friend Fisher, "I am out of it and am happy, and endeavour to keep myself unspoiled. I have a kingdom both fertile and populous, my landscape and my children." The underlying problem was that the ever-increasing population of the young family was steadily weakening Maria. In March 1825, Maria gave birth to a fifth child, a girl, prematurely, and was in a sad, weak condition afterwards. Constable's happiness in his family and his paintings turned into a torment of conflicting loyalties. "My life is a struggle between my social affections and my love of art," he wrote to a collector. "I daily feel the remark of Lord Bacon that single men are the best servants of the public. I have a wife in delicate health and 5 infant children. I'm not happy apart from them, even for a few days or hours, and the summer months separate us too much and disturb my quiet habits at my easel." Nevertheless, the following November brought another pregnancy and a third son. Even Constable now felt that 6 children was enough. "I am willing to think of them as blessings," he wrote to John Fisher, "only that I am now satisfied and think my quiver full enough." As contraception was unthinkable, Maria's fate of incessant childbearing was the common lot of Georgian wives. Soon she was expecting a child yet again, and for the last time. A little boy was born in January 1828. Charles Bicknell, who had been ailing for some time, died that spring and turned out to be much richer than he had led everyone to expect, though the subsequent legacy came too late to brighten the life of his eldest daughter. By the autumn, it became clear that Maria's consumption, so long held in check, had reached the final galloping stage. It is impossible to say whether she would have lived longer if she had not had 8 pregnancies in 12 years. Tuberculosis is an unpredictable disease. Leslie, Constable's friend and first biographer, visited the couple in Hampstead a few days before the end. Maria was then on a sofa in their cheerful parlour, and although Constable appeared in his usual spirits in her presence, yet before I left the house he took me into another room, wrung my hand, and burst into tears, without speaking. Maria died on the 23rd of November, 1828. "I shall never feel again as I have felt," Constable wrote 3 days later. "The face of the world is totally changed to me." Constable was finally elected to the Royal Academy the February after Maria's death. "It has been delayed," he commented. until I am solitary and cannot impart it. For the rest of his life, Constable wore mourning. His work became freer and more unfinished than ever. His painting of Hadley Castle near Southend, exhibited at the Royal Academy the following year, seemed to grieve for Maria. The sky is stormy. The ruined stronghold shattered on a rocky shore.
Anton Lesser was reading the final part of Constable in Love by Martin Gayford. It was abridged by Lou Kemp and produced by Jill Waters. Well, next week, one of Britain's best-loved comedians takes a break from his ham-fisted piano playing and mother-in-law jokes to read his very own gusset-ripping novel about the civil war between the north and south of Britain. Les Dawson reads Come Back with the Wind, starting on Monday afternoon at 2:45. I can't wait. And luckily, I won't have to, and nor will you, because you can get a sneak preview of that and lots more, Les, if you join us for our three-hour special, Listening to Les Dawson. That's tomorrow morning at 9, and again in the evening at 7.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock now. This is Joanna Pinnock with your drama for this afternoon and the final part of Wilkie Collins' Dark Tale, in which it seems Lydia Gwilt will stop at nothing to get her hands on the Armadale fortune. And a little later, more drama new to 4 Extra. It's Peter Tinniswood's last play, Visitors, written just before his death in 2003. Roy Hudd stars in a haunting drama on the brevity of life and the frailty of love at 9:15. But now we come to the final part of Armadale by Wilkie Collins. The ruthless Lydia Gwilt is convinced that she is the rightful heir to the Armadale fortune, and now she's discovered an astonishing secret which has led to the formulation of a cunning but dangerous plan.
There are two Alan Armadales, both unmarried. The light-haired Armadale, owner of Thorpe Ambrose, who offers the woman who marries him £8,000 a year while he lives, who must and shall marry me for that reason. And the dark-haired, dark-skinned Alan Armadale, who calls himself Midwinter, who has a poor little income which might perhaps pay his wife's milliner, and who has gone to London to make his fortune, believing that I mean to marry him. And whom, well, whom I might have loved once, before I was the woman I am now. And Alan the Fair doesn't know that Alan the Dark is his namesake, because the father of Alan the Dark murdered the father of Alan the Fair, and murder should be kept secret. And Alan the Dark dreams of death, death for his friend or himself. This is my plan. Midwinter marries me privately under his own name. Armadale leaves Thorpe Ambrose a single man and dies in some distant place. I return as Mrs. Armadale, his widow, my marriage certificate in my hand, and prove my claim to his estate. And all that stands in my way is the oafish flirtation that Alan the Fair is conducting with his neighbour's dumpy daughter. But I have found out their assignation, and I will make a third.
Neely?
Alan, I'm here. Have you got it?
Yes.
Have you read it?
I was waiting for you. I found the place.
Well, you read, I'll take notes. I'm going to make two columns, good and bad. Don't look at me, look at the book.
Do you mind giving me a kiss before we begin?
I should mind it very much. This is a serious situation.
Well, I feel as if it would clear my head.
Very well. But only one, mind, and don't lose your place. Pick it up. If that happens again, I will sit with my back to you. Please, will you read?
Law of husband and wife. It may be observed that the law considers marriage in the light of a contract.
Is there nothing about love?
Not a word.
Go on.
Here we are. Incapacities. A prior marriage. having another husband or wife living.
Good. I have no husband, and Alan has no wife. Go on.
Next incapacity, want of reason.
Good. Alan and I are both entirely reasonable.
Next, it is the policy of our law to prevent the marriage of persons under the age of 21 without the consent of parents and guardians.
Bad. I am only 17 next birthday, and circumstances forbid me to confide my attachment in Papa.
And when one of the parties shall be under the age of 21 years, the consent required by this act is that of the father.
Very bad, worst.
Would you mind Gretna Green?
No earthly consideration would induce me to be married by a Scottish blacksmith.
Don't be offended. We must try something else. Young Pedgift!
No! You are not to say a word to anyone here. I will not be profaned by town gossip.
Very well. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go to London.
To London?
What was that?
A blackbird, I...